Hey, good morning.
Morning, Rabbi.
Hey,
good morning,
Jim.
Rabbi.
Hi, everybody. What time do we have? About 11:15?
Yep, it's 8:16 here.
This is gonna work out. I was gonna try a different mic for a second. Let me know if the mic is any better. All right, I'm gonna switch it. Hold on. Any better?
The audio is great.
Audio is great.
Great. I'm here.
Okay. Here, let me ask Les. Les, I just changed the mic. Is this any better for you? Les is joining us on the internet.
Hi, Rabbi.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Morning, everybody. Morning, Rebecca. Hi. Who's that? Oh, Carol. Hi. Carolyn, hi, honey.
Okay, Les is telling us the new mic is great. Okay, good. Interesting. A few years back, I bought what I thought was a much more professional mic, and I'm listening to some of the recordings, and they sound, you know, audible, but not, you know, really, you know, the volume is not so great. And I just recalled last week that I had this original mic that came with a laptop, probably cost a dollar or two, and it works so much better. And Mike, Les is just confirming that. Okay, so we'll go back to the old one. I see that the volume on screen looks like it's gets much louder. Okay. So, all right, so we discussed last week the verse which is talking about a couple of verses. This is Qoheleth 10, verses 5, 6, and 7, is what we took up last week. Primarily what we said was that there was a mistake that King Solomon was saying. It looked like a ruler made an error. What was the reason why he said it looks like a mistake went out from before the ruler? Because he saw that the foolish people were in higher statuses than the rich and the wise people, who were very low. And he saw servants that were riding on horses and officers that were walking on the ground by foot. Really, the reverse should be the case. So we had said is that the problem with this, why he calls this an error, or an evil actually, is because you'd expect it to be an order in terms of something coming forth. But we didn't underline the fact that it's coming forth from the ruler. We didn't emphasize that. I actually just noticed that this morning. Because if a common person would suggest something, he doesn't really have any effect on how society should operate. But when a ruler determines something, or people expect something, there should be a certain order based on the ruler. So it's a poor reflection on the rulers when you see people that are of very low status in the highest places, the highest echelons of society. Now, we said, why did he bring this in? Because we're always looking to see, you know, what the sequence is in terms of, you know, how King Solomon is progressing with his verses. So, and Ibn Ezra, we'll read Ibn Ezra shortly, how he complies with this. Because he originally, you keep in mind, he was talking about how the wisdom is something which is superior. And wisdom is something which is always in the right hand of the wise man. When we said, what does it mean it's in the right hand? It means it's readily available. It attends to him in every area of his life. Because he understands how the world operates. And since the world operates by an intelligent system, so he uses intelligence, and that's why he has a successful life for the most part. But we said the reason why he brings in these cases about how society is inverted, and people who are low are raised up, and people who should be raised up are really low, is because this becomes a question on wisdom, or a question on how you'd expect things to operate. So he's showing you that despite the fact that wisdom is the right approach, there, you're going to find some cases that there's a inconsistency, and that's what Ibn Ezra says. Sometimes it'll be a minority of cases, and that's what Ibn Ezra says on verse 7. He says this verse is from the first verse. It's of the same matter. And he says here in the beginning of 7, actually in 5, he says, there are times, yesh. Yesh means it can be found, but by no means is that the majority of cases. But nonetheless, King Solomon wants to tell us that it can be found that certain inconsistencies do exist. And we said the reason for this. Because there are so many variables at play, and we don't understand, and it could be, you know, God's justice could be at hand, and that's why certain people that we'd assume to be in a inverted position are really raised up. They should really be low down, and people who are low down are really raised up. So we don't have all the knowledge, of course, by no means. So he's showing you in terms of how the universe operates. And although wisdom is the best approach, you will find certain small instances where there may be questions that you'll have. But look what he does now. He moves on. He moves on, and we did touch on this last week. He says in 10:8, he says, a person who digs a pit, he'll fall into it, and a person who breaks down a fence, he will be bitten by a snake. Of course, you know, the meaning is that the fence is up there in order to keep out the wild animals and so on. So if a person breaks that very thing which he constructed to protect him, he's going to be harmed by it. And the same thing, if a person digs a pit, well, then he's creating an opportunity, and he's going to fall into it. So if he digs it, he's going to pay the price. And it continues in verse 9. A person who carries stones, who lifts up stones, so he will be wearied there. He'll become anxious or anguished by them. It'll be a vexation to his spirit. And a person who splits wood, a person goes into the wilderness, the forest, and he cuts down wood, yisakin bum, he's going to be hurt by them. He'll be damaged by them. So clearly those two verses, 8 and 9, are similar. We'll have to see what the difference is in order that to explain the necessity for the second verse. But let's just digest that for a second. Let's just see this context and the sequence from, you know, last week and this week, and also even going back a few weeks where we started this whole area. We was talking about how you know, wisdom is definitely the choice path in terms of how one's supposed to live. So what can we, stepping back, what can we say that King Solomon is doing here with all these verses, you know, starting with the beginning of this chapter, or actually starting with the second verse? The heart of the wise is in his right hand, and the heart of the fool is in his left. And then the way that the fool goes, he even tells people, look at me, I'm a fool. Meaning he's so foolish. And he shows an application of wisdom. If the ruler becomes angry with you, so we talked about how a person should respond using wisdom and the reasons why it will work. So he gives an application of how wisdom is going to be something. Even if the most severe case rises against you, or the one who could do the most damage to you, meaning a ruler, nonetheless, wisdom is something which you should not move away from, you shouldn't budge, and it's something which can resolve, it can diffuse, you know, great calamity. And then it goes into the case of the inverted positions of people in society. And Ibn Ezra says, yeah, but there's just a minority of cases. I believe Sforno also says the same thing. And then he goes now back into this case of digging a pit, and it's going to be damaging to you. So what is he doing now? What is the, if you could try to think about a general, just like one word. What is the subject that he's trying to illustrate to us through these examples? So that's what he's doing. He's giving many examples, but there's a one primary subject that he's addressing here. All right, so Les, you're saying, are they warning a wise person not to abandon wisdom, no matter what the world appears to consider wise? Yes, I would say that. But let's see if we can define. That's also an example. Or maybe that's the lesson of the main, excuse me, of the main category. What is this main category? But again, you know, thinking about what you said, Les, I wouldn't say 100%, because you're saying, are these verses warning a wise person not to abandon wisdom, no matter what the world appears to consider wise? Well, here he's not giving any examples and saying that the world considers something wise. Because the bottom line is that if a person assesses something as wise by himself, that's all you can do. You have to follow that. And whether the world, I mean, it's true, whether the world assesses something as wise or not, that's irrelevant. We'll definitely look into something if a lot of people are saying something. We'll say there might be some reason to draw our attention. But ultimately, we'll decide for ourselves whether we feel that the opinion of the masses is correct or not. We won't look at the fact that there are masses in terms of our ultimate decision. But we will allow the masses to call our attention to something.
Rabbi, is it connected with the idea that the masses tend to operate from a foolish perspective?
I don't think so. I don't think that he's really addressing masses over here. But I don't see that as being the issue. I don't really see him talking about masses. You have to take a few moments and you look through these verses and try to get a sense as a whole, collectively, what's going on with these verses. Why is it that he says that it's a there's an evil that's under the sun, like an error that goes forth from the ruler? What makes it an evil? What makes it an error? And is the audio still good? Everybody can still hear me fine? Yeah.
Yeah, this mic really is very clear. I feel like you're standing right next to me.
Okay.
So I guess it's a good idea to continue to use it. Thank you very much.
Okay. Are you on the phone or the computer?
I'm on the phone.
Okay.
Yeah. My cell phone, believe it or not.
Okay. It's difficult when you have a bunch of verses and try to see where it's, you know, where is he going with it? What's the underlying message? And it's even more difficult if you're asked to just give one single term that would define everything.
Rabbi, is this group of verses talking about ignorance?
I don't see that. Why would we expect, though, this, when King Solomon says in verse 5, in 10:5, that he sees an evil that goes out from before, it's under the sun, and like an error that goes out from before the ruler. So why is it an evil? Why is it an error? Based on what? Well, why does King Solomon view it? It could be. Why do we term something an error or an evil? Why do we do that? What is the definition of error or an evil?
Well, if we go with Sanjigan's definition of evil, which I understand is ignorance, then we would say the person is missing the mark because they are unaware of what reality is.
Okay. He's missing a mark, meaning that it's relative to something. And here he's saying it's we expect something to be coming forth from a ruler and we don't see it. We see the lowest of low riding on horses, and the rich are like the dregs of society. We see servants that are driving around in limousines, and the officers have to walk by foot. Meaning we have a certain expectation, and what we're seeing is something which misses it. And therefore we call that an error. An error is when we have an assessment of how things should operate, and something is not operating that way. So it's an error within that framework. A person made an error in math. He didn't multiply, he used division instead. He moved the decimal point to the wrong direction. I mean, to put it succinctly, there are rules, and we're not seeing them. There's a breakdown in the rules.
Rabbi?
Yes.
May I ask a question? I'm just thinking that in the way I look at it, that something that's an error is that we're not following the truth being Hashem, that we're doing things the way we think something should be done. Instead of we have the rules to follow, we have instructions, so to speak, if you want to look at the Bible, the Commission as an instruction book, was we see all these different cases, and I think that the different parts you're to amend to to show us how people did things, and it didn't work, but it prevented us.
All right, so I think you're saying the same thing I'm saying, that there's a certain rule, there's a certain expectation based on what we witness in the world, and then when we don't see it being followed through, so we call it an error. And certainly it's an error when it's in terms of the position of people in a society, so that we would assume that the ruler would ensure to be set up properly and follow certain guides. Now, if we look at what King Solomon has been doing, he's telling us that wisdom is the right way. This is how a person will find all the positive results and experiences, because that's how the world operates. Meaning, when a person is complying with how the world operates, he's not going to meet with frustration. And wisdom is something which complies with it. And even when in the most tragic of circumstances, when a leader rises against you, you can use intelligence, and this would resolve, this would diffuse. But sometimes we find a deviation, or we find an inconsistency. So he's now throwing a question upon the reader. What do you do in that case? So it's not that man has certain, he's not necessarily saying that man's assessment here is wrong, but he's saying what man meets with is that sometimes he finds a problem. If, according to the standards, according to the rules of how things should operate, and let's take society for example, and you have a ruler, well, you're going to find some cases where what you'd expect to happen, that the people of intelligence and wealth that have more influence are put into positions sometimes where that can't be expressed, and the help they could have afforded society is forfeited. So it's what he's saying is that although we have a system and we have rules, sometimes you're going to encounter something which throws a question. But the question is only because you have a ruler. In this case, you have a society, and you'd expect them to be on top of things. And it could be where it could be that what King Solomon is also intimating to is that you have a world operating, and there's the ultimate ruler, God. And sometimes you think you see things which are clearly based on our own assessments are an injustice. But you can't stop there now. Now, what is King Solomon now trying to do by presenting that to us? See, he's throwing us into a dilemma where he wants the reader to see that although you have these few cases, like Ibn Ezra says, that throw questions upon, what's going on over here, like King Solomon says over here. There's an evil that I see under the sun. But you see, he limits it to under the sun because King Solomon is convinced that all justice and punishment and reward is not limited to this world. We may see something that we think is an injustice, but injustice and justice is not something which is only addressed here. So that's why he says it's evil for those people who only view matters under the sun, like we said so many times. And it's like an error that goes forth from the ruler. But that's where he moves on to verses 8 and 9, and he says, despite that, you must follow the rules. Meaning, even though there are going to be cases that are inconsistent, now what the big question that he threw us into, the dilemma that he threw us into, was, now what do we do? Do we now say that since we see things working great most of the time, and societies are functioning, and they have justice, and people are being pulled over when they're speeding, even though some few people do get away, and the justice system does go after crime, although sometimes there may be a corrupt leader here and there, but for the most part, they are trying to keep justice. They are trying to maintain, an equilibrium in society, which is good for everybody. But since we do find certain cases, or I should say, although we find certain cases that justice isn't meted out, or people who are crooked rise to the top. Now, what are we supposed to do in that case? Are we then supposed to take that one case and now make that our rule? Or do we continue following what our minds tell us? See, clearly, we're going to continue following what our minds tell us, and we'll have to, you know, bite the bullet when certain things don't go. But again, you see the rabbis say it's only a minority of cases. So what King Solomon is telling you is that, unlike the skeptic, we talked about this person I knew who was a heretic, and how they operate is that they don't want to follow the Torah system. And how do they do that? They argue with you, and you could shoot them down and show them how they're incorrect in so many cases, but they'll ask you one question. Where's the evidence of the Jews in the desert for 40 years? And if you can't provide an answer, now what they do is they abandon the entire Torah system. Now, you take the same person, and let's say he gets cancer, and he's got two doctors. One doctor is right 50% of the time, and the other half of the time is wrong. The second doctor has performed 1,000 surgeries, and 999 of them were successful, and one of them wasn't. Who do you think this heretic is going to pick to be his doctor? So clearly, he's going to pick the doctor who's got the pristine record except for 1 out of 1,000 cases. Correct? But you see, he doesn't operate that way when it comes to the Torah. In the Torah, he would basically do is, if he finds that one case where the doctor was wrong, he'll say, forget it, the doctor's no good. And you're applying that to the rabbis. If he can find one question that the rabbis can answer, then he's, because in that case, he's not functioning realistically. He's not functioning objectively. He's looking for a way out. Whereas if his life was on the line, something that was truly mattered to him, you'd see an example of what he truly cares about, meaning there's no emotional bias in that case. There he's looking for the best doctor. He's going to take the one that's not right 500 out of 1,000 times. He's going to take the doctor who's right 999 times out of 1,000. And that will show you, and that's a great argument to these heretics. And again, this is all an illustration of what King Solomon is doing here. He's trying to show you that, yes, you have rules, and yes, you have some minority cases where there's a problem, but does that mean that now you abandon? No. He's trying to illustrate to you that the world does work a certain way, and there are certain cases that you just cannot explain. So what should you do now when you're thrown into that question? That, I believe, is what he's addressing over here. And that's where he goes back to the case of digging a pit. You're going to fall into it, meaning we have rules. He goes back. He doesn't want to leave you with a question. He first tells you the principle. Wisdom is the right path. But there's going to be some cases where you see the people in society that their positions are inverted. Now what do you do? So if you just stop there, you'd have a question without an answer. So he goes on to 8 and 9, and he tells you again, illustrations of how the rules work. And he uses illustration from the natural world. You dig a pit, you're going to fall into it. But like Ibn Ezra says, a wise person will avoid that. Ibn Ezra says that. He says he goes back to that point. That's what all this is an illustration to. If you break down a fence, you're going to get bitten by the snake that the fence was intended to protect you from. But a wise person will not do that. Meaning there are set rules, and this is predominant of how the world operates. To let you know that although you do have some questions in certain cases, how he's trying to illustrate to you, you would agree that there is a certain system. There is a rule. All right, a person is going to lift up stones. It's going to be a vexation to him. It's going to be something which psychologically is going to worry him. It's a lot of work he's going to do. And if a person starts becoming like he has to cut down wood from the forest, well, these things are very large, they're heavy, they roll. You're putting yourself into a certain danger when you start dealing with very large, and you know, cutting down trees, and now you have the potential of the tree falling down in the wrong direction. I mean, there's a lot of variables over there. But that's why he brings these cases on the surface. What is he doing? He's talking about carrying stones and digging pits and breaking fences. It's like out of left field. But now you see what he's doing. You see the strategy of King Solomon, the wisdom of how he wants to present his point that you do have rules, there are exceptions to the case, but the rules operate. That's, if you wanted to sum up what he said, that's what he said. It's, you have to follow wisdom, is the first couple of verses, up to like 2, 3, and 4. And then 5, 6, and 7 are the questions on that, on the rule. Well, you see that status in society is inverted sometimes. Isn't that the question? And his answer is 8 and 9. There are rules. The guy who digs a pit's going to get hurt. If he doesn't dig a pit, he won't. And that's what you have to follow. Because that's what you, your mind tells you. Because there's certain things that you can't answer, does that mean, well, forget it. I'll dig a pit and I'll take a chance. Maybe I won't fall down into the 20-foot pit. Maybe I'll be able to walk on air. That's ridiculous. A person wouldn't say that. You know there are certain rules, despite the fact that you have questions. And even the heretic will follow that in the case when it comes down to his own health. But you see, when it comes to him wanting to wiggle out of having any obligation of Torah and mitzvos, when it comes to something which is inconvenient because it'll cause the discomfort and it'll, you know, restrict me in terms of my pursuit of just leisure and freedom and doing what I want. So as long as he's got one unanswered question, then he's going to use that as an out. But now you can use this case in Koheles to illustrate to him that that's foolish, because he wouldn't do that in other areas. So the fact that he is applying it over here by Torah shows an inconsistency, and that makes him out to be a fool. Okay, let me just pause here and see if there's any questions or comments. And Les, yes, you do have it. That's right. The underlying message is, keep the course, meaning you follow what your mind tells you is true, even when such examples come about that sometimes you don't have the answer. Now, of course, if the majority of cases was that wisdom didn't work, then you shouldn't follow wisdom. But that's not the case. It's only because it's the minority. Meaning if every single time a person took a hammer and he banged a nail, some building would explode in his neighborhood, he wouldn't do that. But we see that's not the case. When you take a hammer and you bang a nail, it helps to build a house better. It's just the opposite. It does have a certain natural course. So we will keep on using nails and wood and hammers because we see that that is, you know, all the time that that works.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Sometimes when somebody sees something that's so blatantly obvious, they look to make fun of it or say, oh, it's either too good to be true or it's just impossible, it couldn't happen. And they talk themselves out of it, not to believe, so that they give themselves the permission to believe what they feel they want to believe.
All right, so that's a fool. A person will deny his senses. That's a fool.
But they bring others along with them, which is so dangerous. They convince others along the way.
Yep, that's awesome. That's also a case. That's where a person really has to become free from looking to please others or just follow people, and he has to use his own intelligence.
Yes. That's why it's important when I was reading your works in different places and in your book also, how you're not supposed to just follow just because somebody has a title or wears a certain kind of garb or clothing that they know, they don't necessarily know. And sometimes you have to just use your mind.
Well, always, yeah, always have to. We never look at externals.
Yeah, it was so good in your book. It was put so well.
Thank you.
I appreciated it. Thank you.
All right, so is this clear to everybody? Do you see now the actual path that King Solomon took over here, and how the verses that on the surface seem to be unrelated, but now we see an illustration of a message. Is it clear to everybody?
I think so. So you're saying that all these cases really are addressing the issue that you raised about, you know, the person who will look at everything working, but if there's one thing that he can't explain, he'll throw out the whole deal.
Right, and that would be a foolish thing.
Right.
I mean, it could be our own ignorance why we don't understand why it's working in this case. Maybe the king has some sort of a ploy, and that's why he puts something who's very low in a very high position. Maybe he's got a plan. We don't know, but it would be foolish for us to then say, well, it's better for the ignorant people to be riding on the horses and being leaders. We'll never come to that conclusion, even though we might see it in one case. We do see that it's clear. A person with wisdom is the best person to be a leader, not the fool. And that's not even subject to whether we see it in action. Even in theory, we understand that that must be. Certain things we understand by reason, and certain things we understand based on experience, meaning we understand how the world works only by witnessing it. So that's what demands our action. I mean, the world, let's say it was a different way. Let's say water flowed from low locations to high locations. So if that's how we saw it in the world, it would be foolish to be making dams, downstream. We'd be making them upstream. And navigation would have to be reversed because of the flow of water. But we don't see it that way. But that's only because of how we experience it. So certain things we do, we operate in a major way because that's how the world operates. So we want to comply with what we witness happening in reality. We see objects and we see the properties and behavior, the natural law of these objects. And they're consistent. That's what law means. Law means a behavior that is consistent. So based on that, we then, like for example, we don't build houses in the middle of the water. We understand that the water rots the wood, and it can loosen up the foundation, and so on. So based on how we see things operating, the nature of wood, the nature of water, the need for a structure to live in that's not going to fall down every year, something that will last for decades or hundreds of years. It's so much effort to build a house, so why would we want to build it again next year? So based on all the considerations, we follow how the world operates. And if it worked a different way, we'd work a different way. But then there are certain things that are not based on what we experience, but just things that we know intelligently. But again, that's still going to be based on, to a certain extent, on how the world operates. So when we say that wisdom is definitely better for a leader to be wise than to be a fool, so that is not something we have to see in practice. So, and this goes back to Maimonides, where he says there are only three things that a person should accept as true. That which he experiences in, sensual, his senses of perception, so what he witnesses in the world. So when you witness something, then you know it's true. That's number one. Number two, you accept as true that which your mind tells you. Wisdom is something which can achieve a lot more than foolishness. Or if you see a broken piece of glass, so you know, your mind tells you, even without seeing the event, your mind tells you that the glass was a unit prior to it being broken into pieces right now. So wisdom is the second area. That which your mind tells you must be true is the second thing which we accept as true. And the third is what we have from a transmission from the Torah. Because we know that must have occurred, that event of Sinai. And the transmission coming to us, no way that it could have been fabricated. So this we know is definitely, we have this, that it's on authority from God. So those are the only three matters a person should accept as true. But I think we come away with a very first of all, really appreciation for how King Solomon writes and his message, of course, but also now we have a response now, like the rabbis say, know how to respond to a heretic. So this is a very good resource in terms of what he illustrated over here, of how by following the rules, there are rules, And even though sometimes we don't see it 100% of the time, that is not grounds to abandon them. So I think this can be applied to many, many areas. Whether it's raising your children, whether it's interpersonal relationships, to resolve issues, it's very important to have a commitment to reality in all areas. A simple example would be where you have a son in high school, and he wants to start following a bad group of kids, and he may say, well, you know, they don't seem to be, you know, they seem to get away with it. You know, they're doing this and that, and they're having a great time, they're having fun. So then the great responsibility will show in the bigger picture of how many other cases it didn't happen that way. And the majority of cases where people are not staying in school, and they're taking drugs, where they're deviating, and look what happens to them down the road. A lot of them die from overdose, and a lot of them are without jobs, and their lives are a wreck. And you line up all the cases. And you can say to your kid, yeah, maybe right now, number one, you're only looking at what your friends are doing in this current state, this week, this month. That's a very isolated sampling. But why don't you take a look at how, throughout time, people who follow this path, what happened to them? Now you're using this idea of rules. And you have to make sure that you give a good sampling, too. Like a lot of times people, and that's what we said so many times here in Kohelis, that the people, the fools, that King Solomon is quoting when they say it's better to be a live dog than to be a dead lion. Because they're taking a sampling only from the life under the sun, only from earthly existence. That's all they're evaluating. They don't realize that there's a whole another existence that greatly overshadows the amount of time that we're here on earth. But because they have a myopic view, they're looking at just a small sampling. And they say that's everything? So of course they're going to make very grievous errors. It's like a person taking, a person never saw a certain species of animal before. So somebody brings into the laboratory the fingertip of this species. And he makes all these assessments and assumptions based on just seeing the fingertip. That'd be ridiculous to do. He has no idea whether this thing is amphibian, reptile, mammal, fish. Just based on the fingertip, he has no idea. And to make any assessment is wrong based on looking at such a small sampling. Same thing with history. You can look at one day in the history of England, and there was maybe a glorious time, whatever. But if you step back and you look at the entire hundreds of years of its history, then you see a whole different picture. So perspective is everything. And that's what he's saying here in terms of the rules. So we have to really take that to heart. But I think it's a very nice lesson just from these few verses.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Yes, I think in terms of the boy who's in high school, I think it's a typical thing. I see it also. There's men who are afraid to lose the friendship or the closeness, so to speak, with the son. So they try to be more lenient because they want to continue to be a friend. But that's the whole key. That's the whole mistake. A parent is a parent. Could be friendly, could be loving and everything else, but a friend to allow all this hurtful thing to go on is not really a parent. He's becoming more of one of the boys than being the parent. He's not doing his job. And a lot of people are afraid of doing that because they're afraid they'll lose any kind of closeness that they already have. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with that?
Well, I mean, the approach is, I think, the best approach for a parent and a teen is that you don't be an authority. I heard Rabbi Chait once talk about how when the child is young, 5, 6, 7, and they keep running out to the street. So you could explain a certain amount, but sometimes you just got to grab the hand, pull them off the street, and that's it. But that type of approach can't work once you have a child that's a teenager. Now they're coming into their own, they're developing an identity, they have a sense of a certain amount of rebelliousness too, and you don't want to throw fuel on the fire of that rebellion, which is merely natural. You want to do is completely sidestep that. So if there's any type of discussion, it should be something where you should always be friendly, always be fair, yeah, be consistent. A friend of mine once said that the three F's, you know, always when you're negotiating, he was talking about business, but it works with, you know, relationships too. Firm, fair, and friendly. So firm meaning that you have a position that you're clear about. Fair, that you come across that your concern for them is no less than your concern for yourself. That's what fairness is. Because a lot of times a kid will say, oh, you know, you just want it for yourself. That's what you want, Mom. That's what you want, Dad. So they feel that it's not fair. And friendly, to keep it on a very light tone. Don't let it get into an aggravated situation where the emotions will flare up in the child and they'll shut up or they'll run out of the room. That'll be completely destructive. It's counterproductive. The way to do it is to, like we illustrated, you show that there are certain principles how things work. And you talk about how to get to certain goals and what are things that are good and what are things that are worthwhile and what's going to derail you from that. And of course, ultimately, it's the teen's decision. If it gets to a point where there's danger involved in life, of course, then you take more drastic measures. But at this point, we're just talking about, you know, advising, and you see them making certain decisions and give them a certain amount of respect. That's something which I think they'll value, and they will want to preserve their relationship with the parent because they like that. If their very state of mind at that age is to have a certain independence and to feel good about themselves, if the parent gives that by showing respect and treating them like an equal, then the child will want to preserve that relationship with the parent, and because it feels good to have that relationship. And they may not even be getting that from their friends. Their friends are probably fighting with them who's going to be the leader of the group. That's something which they're not getting from the group. So it's a very, I think, a wise thing. You have to understand psychology, understand what they're going through, not to count the thing. A lot of times parents will just want to be forceful on the parent. That's it. I mean, I'm sure you've heard this numerous times. And that's because it's a foolish parent. The parent themselves is still stuck in that state of mind where they were a teen and they were trying to fight for power. And now they finally get kids, now they finally have an out where they can be living vicariously through the kid or exerting their will, their power. I've got children, I can control them. That's a real high to a lot of parents. But that's a pitfall. And what the parent has to do is have the concern for the child at the forefront. And the way that is by first intelligently understanding what the motives are in the child, what the emotions they're going through, and what's going to be a very fair, effective type of argument, what's going to be received the best by the student. And again, you know, different ages will require different tactics, but they do require tactics and strategies. And it doesn't mean in any way that you're not being honest. It means that you're doing something which is the best thing for this child, whether it's your child or somebody else's child. And then there's ways of talking to your friends who you think they're maybe doing something incorrect in raising their children. That's even more, you know, volatile sometimes. You know, you want to exacerbate the situation that the parent is already in. You see they're fuming up with their teen. And how you want to definitely help them somehow, that takes even more thought, I think. And how to approach it and what the right time of the day is and what mood, how to present it. You see, even when Nathan was going to tell King David that he sinned with Bathsheba, so he didn't come out and tell him that you did something wrong by taking this woman. And they gave divorces before they went. So Uriah had divorced Bathsheba. So there was no, he didn't take a married woman. So whatever the error was that Nathan was saying, he came into David. And he's, because what David did was he took this woman. David had all these wives, and yet he took this woman who had been married to this one man. And they gave divorces when they went to war, just in case they got killed, they wouldn't be waiting and waiting and couldn't remarry if the husband never came back and they couldn't find the body. So when David did this, and he took this woman, so He was punished by God. He lost the first child from her. But the way Nathan approached him, he gave a parable. He said to King David that there was a man in the city, and he was wealthy and had all these herds and herds of sheep. And then there was another man who had one little sheep that he brought up from his youth, and he loved it and he cherished it and so on. And the rich man came and he took that one sheep from the poor man. So King David was enraged and he said, that man must be killed or punished, whatever he said over there. So once he was able to look at a case like that objectively, where he was not on the defense, so then Nathan said to King David, you are that man. Then David understood the metaphor. He understood the analogy was to him. So there's a lot to be learned in terms of, you know, all these cases we have in the Torah, how to approach matters. And in order to allow a clearer picture to emerge, sometimes you can't talk about the person and name them. You have to talk about a theoretical case. This way the guard is down and they can be objective. And then when they finally agree, then you show them, okay, apply it to yourself, because that's what you just did.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Sure.
That clears up a lot of areas. Sometimes it's so hard, you know, when somebody is an adult and they're a parent, it's very hard to be a parent when they're afraid they may lose the precious relationship they think they established with their son or with their daughter, whatever the case may be. And it's at that crucial time that they have to stand up and not be afraid and show their self-fear. It's not a joke.
Yep.
It's not a joke. It's like taking a turn in the road. It's a fork in the road, and if you don't say, go this way, they'll start on the wrong way, and there's no way of coming back. Thank you very much.
Okay, any other questions or comments? I guess we'll wrap it up. Let me see if there's everything clear. Doug, you had a question before? Is it clear?
I'm good, thank you.
Okay, Les, how are you doing online? Let me know if everything's clear. Jim, Cal?
I think she's good.
Okay. All right, so I guess we'll wrap up here. We'll pick up with a verse 10. We'll pick up next week verse 10, and we'll move forward. All right, so everybody have a great week.
You too, Rabbi. Thank you.
Okay, my pleasure.
Thank you. Have a good week, everybody.
Okay. Okay, Les. Have a great day. Good week. We'll see you next week.